Hello listeners, and welcome to the AfriWeta podcast, where we live to celebrate African history, people and culture by telling our story. As always, our hope is that this fills you with enough curiosity to go and do your own deeper research. Karibuni to any new listeners to the AfriWeta world. We invite you to check out previous AfriWeta episodes, which can be found on this podcast platform. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We are headed to East Africa to explore the Burundi Kingdom. A shout out to my East Africans out there, AfriWeta has landed on your borders. Before we begin, a quick note, please remember to visit us on our socials. Our handle is at AfriWeta, where we shall post interesting facts, stories, updates, and links for further study for all you lovely people. But for now, just sit back and enjoy the journey. Let's start with a modern location. AfriWeta, let's take out those maps and trace where we are today. Now, if you go to what is the intercostrin of East Africa, right there by the Great Lakes, the Kingdom of Burundi's borders are one of the few African nations that are still largely the same as a modern state, which is now Burundi. Going clockwise to the north, you have Rwanda. Coming to the east and south is Tanzania. And lastly, to the west, there is a natural border of Lake Tanganyika, which it shares with the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, purely for context, now that you all know where we are, let's just start with a few notes when we're going into the origin story, okay? So, the kingdom is said to have been formally cemented by the late 15th century, and truly centralized by the early 16th century. So, you know, about the 1530s, thereabouts. And in the process, it had absorbed part of the then dominant kingdom of Busegera, which is also partly taken up by Rwanda, during the kingdom's expansion in the 1800s upon the Busegera's collapse. We shall see a little bit more about this later. Secondly, as always, there are actually more than one origin stories, and here we're talking about two main stories about the origins of this particular kingdom. The Kanyaru, which relates to Gihanga, and then Nkoma from the Buddha, which we shall look at both for completeness. Cool? But in the course of this episode, AfriWeta does lean a little bit more towards the latter. And then the last key thing to put up front is the identification of the different communities in Burundi and in the region. Basically, what is the more contemporary way in which they are labeled as the Hutu, the Twa, and the Tutsi peoples. It's important to acknowledge this, but for AfriWeta, we shall not dwell on the deep political and socio-economic significance that is placed in modern times, and that, as I'm sure you're aware, have been used to some devastating effects. AfriWeta shall refer to these labels as identifiers in the most basic of ways. Right, now that we have all of that out of the way, let's see how these communities feature in the origin story. Starting with the Twa. They are said to have been the closest to the original inhabitants of the lands. The next, we have the farmers, who are generically classed as the Hutus, who came upon the lands and, finding it suitable to do so, settled in circa 800 AD to 1000 AD. They are said to have migrated from the Central African region and brought with them the knowledge and the skills around more intense farming and agriculture. The last arrivals to the region were the Tutsi from the 15th, 16th century. They were pastoralists and favored a more military style of society, and with them came the consolidated concept of monarchy. The leader then was Ntare I, Kivimira, Savuyimba, Rushasi, Kamabarantama, more commonly known as Ntare Rushatsi. FYI, some say he was actually just a composite of ideology, a human face to the process of the growth of the kingdom in his final machination. Here at Afriwetu, he is considered a real live human. From this arrival, which is actually considered more of a military conquest, if we're being fair, is where we'd see the two main origin threads for Burundi diverge. And this is more or less, we can split them geographically into the north and south led. It is here that we see the main contention between the two, basically the origin of the founding dynasty and royalty, the Ganwa. So now I hope we're all together. Let's take a quick look. So seeing as we've already mentioned him earlier, let's look at the line associated with Gihanga, the Kanyaru tradition. It stems from a close association with the north. The proponents of this cycle claim that Ganawa were of the Tusi heritage and direct descendants of Rwanda nobility, the house of Nyinginya, whose founder was, you guessed it, Gihanga. And it is from this heritage that there was a cycle of four Ganwa kings. Those who do not buy into this version criticize it as being a version that is embedded in colonial history, which brings in with it the idea of a hermetic link. Thus, they do not accept it as being indigenous to Burundi itself. Then you have the opposite origin story, the Nkomak tradition. What does it say? Well, this version, which is considered the earlier version of history, links the Ganwa dynasty, for them which only had two Ganwa cycles, to a very Hutu origin from the Buha. The claim the followers have is that the dynasty was from the southeast and not based on the northern invasion from the Rwanda kingdom. So a very opposite view, right? Now, before we leave this section, it's worth pointing out, and those of you Afriwatu who have been with us from the start of this series will recall, as faintly as it may be, the Rwanda kingdom when we spoke of the Bimanuka, those who fell from heaven. Is it ringing any bells? Okay, if not, then go back again and listen to it for the first time with this kingdom in mind when linked to the legend of Gihanga. And there's actually a Legends episode coming up about him. Actually, it should be in the next few episodes to be exact. Afriwetu would love to hear back from the descendants of the civilization on their take and thoughts, noting that the identification of the communities is still a hotly contested and sometimes quite devastating issue. So we'd love to hear from the descendants themselves. So leaving that behind, we're now going to look at the governance and rulers. In this section, we shall combine the two as they blend sort of like one into the other. So the kingdom was a monarchy, which followed a ritual kingship led by the Mwami, the king. He was a central political point of power and influence. The first of the Mwamis was the founder who we heard of before, Ntare Rushatsi, from circa 1530, which is then said to be when he formally became the monarch of the burgeoning kingdom. He's credited with bringing forth and consolidating in Burundi the idea of this ritual kingship. He was able to get buy-in by leveraging and incorporating the Emandwa beliefs that were commonly practiced in the region. And he invoked the powers of the Kiranga spirit. The kingdom followed what was a typical hierarchical political system with the Mwami at the head. And he was supported by a powerful and influential nobility and ruling class. This group, the aristocracy, we've heard of them before, were the Ganwa, and they can be best understood as a successor class that had within it the royal princes basically waiting to become the next Mwamis. The Ganwa had political, social, and economic status, controlling and having access to great wealth, power, and influence. So you can also imagine that it was within them that you would find many inner conflicts and political skirmishes as this ruling class sought to control the central government. The Ganwa were wealthy landowners, controlled production and distribution of the kingdom's assets, with the people paying to them tribute and taxes. And it's from this that Afriwetu learned of Ubugabire, which is said to be a social contract where the ruling class, in exchange for being the ruling class, it was expected that they pulled their own weight and provided protection to the people. And as we move to the ruler's part, I just wanted to share a fun fact about the significance of drums in the Burundi Kingdom's royalty. The sacred Rukinzo drum was part and parcel of the Mwami's life, always the two accompanying each other. So from when the Mwami woke up to when he fell asleep, it created a literal drumbeat and rhythm to his reign. And when there was a new Mwami, the Rukinzo was renewed. We shall hear a little bit more about drums later when talking about its place in society. So with that nice segue, we can move to the rulers. And I wanted to highlight two Mwamis in particular, each of whom Afriwetu sees as having significantly impacted the kingdom's fortunes and also those who had the longest reigns. So we have Ntare Rugumba and Mwezi Gisabi. Let's begin with Ntare Rugumba, who was active from 1796 and ruled until 1850. He is respected and celebrated for both his military and political gains for the kingdom. He conquered the surrounding lands, increasing the borders of the kingdom. Some of the noble polities actually included parts of the collapsed kingdom of Busegera, as well as the other northern areas of the Imbo regions, and Bushubi, Bugufi, and for a short period, Kinyana, which were all in the northeast, and then the Rusizi Valley in the northwest. Then moving to the east, he occupied the eastern shores of Lake Kivu and Buyogoma. And by the time he was done, he had actually doubled the size of the kingdom. That was no small feat. And remembering that Burundi had no standing army. Another fun fact to throw in there, the kingdom's borders as a result of his conquest pretty much represent what we know as Burundi's border today. Remember I mentioned it in the very beginning. So, once he was successful in his conquests, Ntare Rugumba would then appoint his sons to govern the conquered lands. So as part of his strategy, basically, this was part of his strategy to maintain administrative power. This proved to be quite a complicated and difficult task in the long run. He was, de facto, the last fully independent Mwami of the kingdom, to be honest. And speaking of sons, our next Mwami happens to be just one of Rugumba's youngest sons and his direct successor, Mwezi Gisabi. So Mwezi took over the reins of the kingdom circa 1852. His rise to the throne was not that smooth, with factions allied to his older brothers questioning it. One of their issues was his lineage. Was he really the right heritage to be a Mwami? Question for another day. But from this and other succession issues, two camps emerged within the Banagwa nobility. One was identified with the sons of Ntare, named the Batare. The other, Bezi, was linked to the sons of Mwezi. So not so happy families. But regardless of all this, he was able to swat off the competition and stay on the throne. But this is not what his contribution is to the kingdom. Actually, it was how during his reign, he introduced new systems, sort of like this multi-tiered admin system, which emerged and broken down was, number one, he designated the area of Muramvya as central to the kingdom, and that was the one that he controlled. Secondly, there was a split of the administration between the most loyal royal brothers and sons, who were each given their own regions to govern. Thirdly, this split in administration was made along clan and family lines. What it looked like was that in the west and the northwest regions, the kin of Mwezi's older brother, Ndivyarie, held court as a reward for his early support. But please remember this name for later. Then we moved to the east and southeast, which fell under the Batare, Ntare Rugumba's line. And lastly, in the West and Northwest, the Non-Banganwa nobles, the noble Hutu lineages, were in charge, and they prospered by leveraging their access to Lake Tanganyika's trade networks. And finally, as we leave this section, let me finish off with a hint of what is to come with the demise of the kingdom. It was in this ruling class, the Banganwa themselves, their succession fights within these powerful elites against each other were pretty intense and, sadly, not infrequent. This, as we shall see later, contributed significantly to Burundi's end. But now let us slide over to the next section where we shall combine the kingdom's society and religion. So the makeup of the people is in today's context given in very linear lines of the Twa, Hutu and Tutsi. We shall, of course, acknowledge these communities, but to avoid generalization, shall use these terms in their most fluid of forms. So to set the context, the three can be identified as follows. The Twa people were the original inhabitants and were closer to the lands. They were said to hold a special place in the religion of the lands. The Tutsi were the royal clans, and specifically within them, the Banyanyunguru and the Hima were at the top. The Hutu could also be found in the nobility clans and classes and had political and social influence. In Burundian society, identities were based on the idea of ethnicity and social class, but it was adopted in various ways. You could find a person whose ethnicity and class could be across different societal levels. And I think this is best illustrated by this example and what it really looked like in reality, because we can otherwise get really lost in the semantics. So the ruling Ganwa dynasty were considered to have Hutu origins, right? And at the same time, they were also considered to be closely linked to Tutsi on a social and political level, with them being all part of the overall noble class. The other noble house were the Hima, who claimed a kinship with the Tutsi and were themselves a powerful political class. So in this scenario, on the very basic level, we have two communities linked to royalty and the ruling class, which shows that the idea of class was not strictly related to one's ethnicity. And in some cases, one could move ethnicity by a move in a social class. Are we together? I hope so. Now, leaving that there as you scratch your heads, let's go to society in general. Burundi had formulated a very distinct Rundi tradition before it became the kingdom that we know of today. This tradition was as a result of centuries of its relationships and interactions with its lakeside neighbors. That being the case, the arrival of Ntare Rushatsi did not mean a sudden and complete overhaul, but in fact, he leveraged and built on an existing Rundi social economic structure. He incorporated the traditions and customs into a modified political system. It was guided and led from within the community rather than an external influence. The smaller polities and practices that existed were combined into something that was not foreign to them and therefore quite easy to adapt to. And then to enforce this political system and create a sense of unity, there were different customs and ceremonies that were utilized. We shall look at two here. The Abahingantahe and the Umunganuro. The Abahingantahe were a group of political elders who were held in high regard and integral to the running of the kingdom. They were the people's representatives in the central government and vice versa. They held the roles as both judiciary and moral compasses, and typically they were from the Hutu community. Then we have the Umunganuro, which was the annual first fruit ceremony. It is at this ceremony that royal rituals, such as the first fruits, main ones being sorghum and millet, of the harvest were then presented to the mwami. This and other ceremonies were under the purview of the kingdom's special group of ritualists. They managed and took charge of them. They were the healers, the spiritual leaders, and the keepers of the royal tombs. They were usually from the Hutu peoples, and many were women. So in the Umungaru, once this ceremony was concluded, the people were able to commence the planting season. A key part of Burundian society was the importance of the mighty drum. You cannot talk of the Rundi culture without giving a nod, an understanding, and homage to how integral the drum was to it. We already heard earlier of the significant place the drum held in royalty, literally the rhythm of the Mwami. Now let's look at its place in society overall. So the Burundian drum, Karayenda, the Rukinzo was a royal drum. So the Karayenda was one of the kingdom's sacred objects. The drums were made from leather pulled over specially chosen wood from specific trees. They were treated with reverence, and this included the drums having certain conditions set, for example, how it was played or even made. So they could only be made under the order of the Mwami. They were not just these simple, common musical instruments. And just as the drums could not be made by anybody or ordered by anybody, they could also not be played by just anyone. Drums were to be played by only those who were classed as ritualists and of the Gishora lineage. Women were allowed to play the drums way back, and it's only in recent years that this changed. And to keep their presence, the drums are modeled from a woman's body shape, and parts of it represented certain body parts, certain women, female body parts. But this is a whole other study in Burundian culture that AfriWetu really encourages you to read up on because it's fascinating. There were conditions as to when the drums could be played as well, which is basically at very special occasions, including the annual first fruit ceremony, the Omunungaru, coronations, and state funerals. This reverence for the drums is still seen in modern times where the drums are used as part of the more official state-type ceremonies. The traditions have been kept alive by those who are from the lineages of old. Burundi drumming in itself has its own signature and is known to be quite dramatic and spectacular as these drummers beat the special drums with drumsticks and how they perform this on stage. Honestly, it's a sight to behold, but don't just take my word for it. In 2014, the UN's heritage agency, UNESCO, classed the Burundian drums performance as inscribed on the representative list of intangible cultural heritage of humanity. Like, it's special. Now, as we're about to leave this section, let's quickly look at the religion and then wrap this part up, okay? So key players in the religion were the ritualists who we've mentioned and who we have bumped into a number of times by now. They hold a special status in society, and within their ranks one would find a number of women holding spaces of power. These ritualists also acted as both representatives and intermediaries between the people and the deities. One of these deities was Kiranga. Kiranga was a powerful and quite prominent deity. He was closely associated with the Rangombe spirits in the neighboring Rwanda kingdom. And both of them were linked to the Emandwa belief system that could be found in the Interlocustrian. It was under the reign of Mwami Ntare where the recognition of Kiranga was reinforced, starting in the courts in the early 18th century and building on a belief system that was already in place from years gone by. And with those few notes, let's now swiftly move to trade and economy of the kingdom before we close with the demise. So the kingdom is said to have been formally cemented, as I've said before, in the late 15th century. It was part and parcel of the trading civilizations in the Intercalate and the broader regional trade. The people would use the trade routes across the lakes, notably Lake Tanganyika, and with land with their highland neighbors. The lake trading meant boats, and the Rundi were known for their skills and craftsmanship in their boats. In fact, this was so much so that all who interacted, and even those who didn't, recognized this skill. This is from their fellow Africans to the Arab and European foreigners. It is worth noting here that for the longest time, there's a great bias against Burundi by the latter two, especially from around the latter 19th century. They actually dared claim that there was no relationship between the kingdom and other civilizations or settlements or peoples. It's madness, anyway. They spoke of a lack of trade or interaction just because the Rundi were not particularly interested in dealing with them. And actually, they actively fought them back as they tried to attack and raid the lands for slaves around the 1870s. So it's very likely that this view is more about hard feelings than not about the kingdom, because it proved to be that that kingdom was effective in fighting against the foreigners and their agents. This is mentioned here as a more negative view, which is still touted to this day, yet nothing could be further from the truth based on the history in this area. But it is important to be aware of this very narrow prism that this civilization is viewed. But for sure, no Afriwatu listening in would be satisfied with such without digging deeper, right? Anyway, back to more important matters. The kingdom interacted with its neighbors a lot on the socio-economic front as well as trade. There was a constant flow and sharing of ideology and transitions and traditions across the borders, as well as trade and commerce at a very grand scale, prior to the 19th century and the advent of the foreigners. So, for example, the kingdom traded in a vast variety of goods such as livestock, crops. Agricultural technology was long established in the area, dating back to at least 8000 BC. There was salt, because there were natural salt deposits in the region, areas like at Uvinza, who are commonly known to have salt production tracing back to the 6th century AD, and Burundi was a major consumer. Then you had trade in iron and iron products, which we know in this area, there was an abundance of iron ore and mines. And there's also very great smithing tradition. For the Burundi people, we're also able to trace metallurgy going back no later than the 6th century AD. And there's some claims to as far back as the 1st century AD, actually. So it was clearly an active and involved kingdom in the area. It was prosperous. The people were there was freedom of movement of peoples, trade. So then the question is, what on earth happened? Well, let's go and find out as we wrap up this episode with the demise. In 1890, on the 22nd of December, Ubwirakabiri came upon the lands. There was a darkness twice, two eclipses. It was almost like a sign of things to come, the end of an era, the demise of a kingdom. The kingdom's end could be boiled down to a few key issues it faced in the late 19th century, which in no particular order fall under these three broad headings. First, the internal threats from the infighting due to succession. Second, the misfortunes that befell the region. And lastly, who could forget, the usual suspects and most devastating of all, the external threat from the colonizers. Let's take a brief look at each of these. Let's start with the misfortunes. These came one after the other from the late 19th century. The land saw the spread of epidemics as well as natural disasters which hit them hard. Examples such as in 1891, when the kingdom saw the spread of rinderpest, which is essentially a plague, and this decimated almost three quarters of the bovine population, which is a harsh blow to this region, where livestock and animal husbandry were big for livelihoods, social standing, the economy, and so on. Then the bovine epizootic disease that could jump species from animals to humans, so another devastating effect around 1892. And then, as if that wasn't enough, in around 1893, here comes smallpox, and then a yaws outbreak to seal the deal. It was rough, people. Then next up, we have the internal and external threats, which overlap. Here, the external are both the colonizers and the regional dominant powers, namely the Nyamwezi, whose attacks on the kingdom affected its economy and political influence. But to be fair, mostly the colonizers. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. They come into play at the very end. So let's start with the internal issues, which really did not help matters. The succession battles within the Ganwa were constant, as the different nobles and camps would create allies and thus enemies, depending on the Mwami and powerful and influential court of the day. And sometimes these allegiances changed drastically and with dramatic effect. A classic example is that of Mwezi Gisabo's older brother, Ndivyarie. Remember him? We met him earlier when hearing about how his sons and king were granted rule over sections in the western areas of Burundi as a reward for his support. But this changed once he was accused of overreaching his power, which led to his exile. And to truly shut him down, he was then assassinated. I mean, how fortunes changed. But there are other stories that speak to betrayal and discontent by other Ganwa over a period of time, and some which contributed to the demise more indirectly. But for this AfriWetu episode, we shall highlight two key characters whose allegiances caused more issues than the others before them, Kilima and Mankongo. Kilima, who some consider of noble Ganwa blood, hailed from the northwest, Bushi to be exact. He had strong links with the coastal traders and was able to acquire firearms, which he used with devastating effect against Mwezi, with the help of the Germans. This alliance was short-lived, though, because the Germans then reneged and decided to build on the concepts of central government, using the same central government players that they had opposed. And with this turn of events, Kilima found himself out and exiled from the kingdom. Then we have Mankongo, who was a close ally of Mwezi. In fact, he was family. He was Mwezi's son-in-law. But this bond was severed and things changed when his wife died and he and Mwezi fell out big time. Mankongo then went out and made new friends with the colonizer Germans. I know, right? Anyway, like Kilima, he eventually found himself on the wrong side of their plans, and his fate was slightly different in that after he had been accused of treason against the colonizers, I know the irony is not lost on us, trust me, and of stealing arms, he found himself executed. And then in the midst of all these, the colonizers slyly gained a hold in the region and were able to force themselves upon the kingdom. And with a gun to his head, dragged out of his own home, Mwezi was forced to accept colonial authority from the colonizers, who would then agree to support his central rule and authority as if he had a choice in the matter. And so by the end of all this, Mwezi having succumbed to colonization, with him fell the kingdom of Burundi, and sadly, by 1896, it was no longer sovereign. So what else was going on in the world when this was happening? I'm going to definitely murder some of these pronunciations. I do apologize. Hadiwijaya sent his adopted son and son-in-law, Sutawijaya, who would later become the first ruler of the Mataram dynasty of Indonesia, to kill Aira Penangsang in 1568. In 1587, the reign of Abbas I marks the zenith of the Safavid dynasty, modern day Iran. In 1592 to 1598, Korea, with the help of the Ming dynasty of China, repels two Japanese invasions. Between 1598 and 1613, Russia descends into anarchy during the Time of Troubles. In 1870 to 1890, the long depression in Western Europe and North America. In 1889, Brazil had a republican military coup, which established the Brazilian Republic. And then in this period, among others, Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman were two of the many African-American abolitionists who helped fight against slavery. So as we bring it home, I've been very careful not to emphasize the terminology around the Twa, Hutu, or Tutsi, as so often these divisions have been used to devastating effect by the colonizers and then by African leaders in Burundi itself to push their own political agendas. This is not to say that the community should not be acknowledged and given their due cultural respect, but that just that, it should be respectful. We should also be careful not to think of these communities and other African ones across the continent as static. The fluidity is one of the things we should embrace and consider. So I thought it was just worth getting that out of the way. With Burundi, there is this woeful and horrible norm to treat the kingdom as this lone, isolated kingdom that was left untouched by trade and outside influences, or indeed having little interaction with its contemporaries. Hopefully this episode has debunked that notion. Burundi was a fascinating kingdom for me personally to study, learning something new at each turn and also seeing as it was its own civilization and not always being paired with Rwanda. One of the dope things was learning about the Burundian drum, which is still a very key part of the culture today. And I expect Afriwatu by now you appreciate the significance of the African drums, right? We have seen many civilizations treat drums in special ways, and I'm certain that for this we have only just scratched the surface. And with that, with the drum roll to the end of our visit to Burundi, make sure you keep doing your own deeper research. And until next time, Mubarikiwe! Que nada gana, hipopótamo de crocodilo.